Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 163 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. We're here every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, or you can download the MP3 after broadcast. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990, as long as you don't mind paying long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so if you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. We have a long interview, or maybe I should say conversation, coming up. So let's get right to it. Jim West is a New York-based independent researcher who, in my opinion, has done amazing work researching the true cause of polio, which we now both agree is and probably was pesticides. And he got there before me. And we worked together on the West Nile virus, the so-called epidemic in 1999 and subsequent years, which was probably very likely due to very old and already sick people being injured by volatiles in the air, possibly a gasoline additive that's used more at higher concentrations in polluted areas. Jim and I have both looked into Zika virus, or the so-called Zika virus, which appears to be another attempt to blame mosquitoes for an illness that is probably environmental. But is it pesticides in the air or water that are causing microcephaly, or vaccination programs, or, as Jim is hypothesizing, ultrasound? I interviewed Jim a while back about his book on the damage caused by ultrasound. The use of this technology, which is not really sound by any normal definition of the term, has increased dramatically for fetuses, similar to the way that the number of vaccines given to children has increased dramatically over the past few decades. Jim has a new book entitled Ultrasound Causation for Microcephaly and Zika Virus, published in 3 parts, available as an ebook or paperback, and we'll put a link in the show notes. Welcome to the show, Jim. I had heard that there was, or I'd read that there was a group of physicians, I believe, in Brazil who had claimed that pesticide use was the cause of microcephaly. And there was a larvicide program where they put larvicides in the water, in the drinking water, with the idea being that it would kill mosquito larvae, which seemed like an incredibly dangerous idea. There also was a vaccine program that was relatively new that was targeted at pregnant women. Now, of course, the CDC ignored those in favor of discovering that a virus was the cause. It's not clear at all that they even looked at any other alternatives. What made you think that ultrasound might be involved?
Well, at first, I thought the same thing you did, which was that the larvicide piroxifen was causative. But then I studied that really carefully, and there's a lot of studies on it, and it's been in use for a long time, and it has never caused any problems like that. I'm sure it's not something we would want in our water, but it's used at very low levels and it's very low toxicity. And the medical people in Brazil give a pretty good argument, pretty good defense, saying that time and location really don't correlate with the epidemic. So that's a pretty good argument. And then the vaccine was not even mandated until, I think, a late 2015. And that's when everybody thought the epidemic was beginning, or that's the way it was publicized, as if it was starting around August or October 2015. However, the epidemic actually started in around July of 2012. And the media plays down the 2012 thing, and because I guess they don't want people to have the impression that this has been going on for so long and they didn't know about it.
It didn't do anything. On what basis do you know that this started back in 2012?
Okay, there's a group called The Network, which is related. It's a nonprofit prenatal evaluation and care group that works as a telemedicine group. It works through the internet as a consulting group.
Let's go back a little further. So how do we know there was even an epidemic of microcephaly? Like, the definition of microcephaly is that you have microcephaly if you're below a certain percentile, like the 10th percentile. But that struck me as weird, because if you take a perfectly healthy problem where you have babies who are all normal by any measurement, 10% of them would be in the lowest 10 percentile. That's by definition.
I know.
So
it is very strange, and I think one reason it's strange is because, I mean, I suspect that they want to cover up a general trend of microcephaly over the decades.
If you're using percentiles,
a percentile, you know.
But I mean, you could have years where you have a lot of babies that have obviously small heads. And you would detect those because they would obviously be in the lowest 10th percentile. But then you could have a years when there's really no such problem, but you would still define certain babies as microcephalic.
Right. It seems to me that you need to observe the population for a while, get an idea of what the head size is, and then assuming that the demographics stay the same, then just measure the head size. And if the head size drops before norm, below a certain level, then you could define that as microcephaly. And actually, that's sort of what Brazil did, which is commendable. They didn't really use the percentile method. What they did is they just historically tracked head size in the region, the epidemic region, and they just noticed that the head size was going down, and as of July 2012, and they also noticed. Now that's a general thing, which is there's a thing. They broke it into two categories: mild microcephaly, which is not easy to detect, you know, unless mm-hmm. you're actually measuring it, and then severe microcephaly, which is a tragic and horrible thing where the head is largely missing from the babies, you know, from on the top where the brain is.
Right.
So they begin to notice this severe microcephaly in around 2014, early 2014. But they also noticed a general trend in 2012, 2013 of mild microcephaly, just using measurements. They used three different standards of evaluation. So they were really trying to be accurate and not follow necessarily a percentile method, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have a
question with all of these measurements. Like, certainly, you know, if you do population measurements and you see trends, then that tells you that something is going on. I think the problem when people go from population statistics to individual statistics is they'll say, okay, a head under this number of centimeters is too small. But there may very well be that the head size is probably related to the overall body weight, and it may be related to the mother in some extent. So you can't say that for every mother, for every baby, you could use the same standard. But of course, people will use the same standard because it's way too complicated to...
It could be race-related even, you know.
Yes.
Yeah,
like a head shape could result in certain heads measuring smaller, even though the volume is about the same, or something like that. Right? There's lots of factors that you would use, but as industrialized humans, we want to simplify it to one or two or three measurements. You do it with a tape measure, but it might not be applicable. And then, of course, these things seem pretty simple, but it's probably not so simple to accurately measure a baby's head when the baby's moving around and that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, they are very concerned about all of those issues in this epidemic. And, they discuss that the relation of head to body is different with different racial groups, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But assuming that the demography is of that region is fairly stable over the since 2012 mm-hmm. And before, then they notice a relative change of head circumference,
okay,
which they call HC. And so the head circumference is did suddenly change in July of 2012, and they begin to see, they didn't see it at the time. This is all from a retrospective analysis of an ongoing collection going into a database by this telemedicine group. So this telemedicine group was perfectly poised to be able to analyze the epidemic. And so it's very ironic because it is this telemedicine group that I am asserting was the cause, inadvertently, of the epidemic, because they were highly involved in prenatal ultrasound operations, an unprecedented
so
routine.
Using telemedicine, they could do the ultrasounds remotely, like they'd have a technician on site, and then they'd have
right.
the doctor, whoever's interpreting the ultrasound, back at a central office somewhere.
Right. It was like it would be like having an expert on particular areas of prenatal medicine and expertise in ultrasound suddenly available to anybody who has a computer. They could be they could be in a clinic hundreds of miles away from the telemedicine headquarters, and they could just plug in like Skype or whatever, but it's not Skype. It's a special mm-hmm. web conferencing software that they have, which includes the ability to transmit ultrasound data as streaming video. So the expert back at the telemedicine group can see the fetus and advise and teach and educate eager operators who want to learn about ultrasound.
And of course, this would, I guess the intention was to bring ultrasound to people who didn't have it. So it would, just by its own nature, increase dramatically the number of ultrasounds, which would be considered a big success for this organization. But I wanted to go back, before we get onto that, because I want to get more into that, but I'm starting to think that they've confused an illness or a condition with a measurement, because microcephaly is really a measurement. We know that certain babies are formed with only partly formed heads or brains, and their heads are very small. So those babies, of course, will have very small heads. The problem is if you use small head as a measurement and call that microcephaly, then you're going to bring in a bunch of babies who may be perfectly healthy, but they have a small head. But their brain is perfectly well formed, and babies grow at different rates, and most babies sort of eventually become children of normal proportions. So by sort of focusing on the measurement rather than the condition, which you kind of said is pretty obvious when you see it. If you see a baby whose head is only half the normal size, you don't need to get out a tape measure, right? You just need to look at the baby and say, this baby has, you know, has been born with an improperly formed head. And I don't know what the consequences of that are, whether the baby is likely to die or just will be, will have brain problems. Like, will it develop normally in terms of the ability to think? But they've expanded the issue by focusing on the measurement.
Yes. Well, it's like an iceberg. You know, you see the tip. The tip is the tragic, really severe microcephaly, where the child is just missing the top of the head.
Mm-hmm.
And that is accompanied with all kinds of other problems, heart defects, all kinds of organ defects, neurological damage.
Right. I mean, that's a serious birth defect. And like a lot of children with serious birth defects, it's usually not just one thing that's gone wrong. It's like something's gone wrong during the development and all kinds of things are wrong. And in many cases, they die even before birth or, you know, don't live very long. Or if they do live, maybe severely disabled physically and mentally.
So it microcephaly is the tip of an iceberg. Severe microcephaly is the tip of an iceberg that represents a disease syndrome, a collection of symptoms, like I was just saying. And demographically, it correlates with mild, you know, it's a distribution curve. It will correlate with mild microcephaly also. So microcephaly is a indicator, even though maybe a very mild case of microcephaly might be perfectly harmless, it's still as a epidemic pattern. As you see that it is part of the distribution curve. When you have the severe, you also have a lot of the mild.
Right. I understand that. I guess the question is, are children who have microcephaly that would not be obvious to a clinician? In other words, the baby's born, and it's a small baby, and, you know, they check, you know, does it cry? Does it latch onto the mother? All those things that they check when a baby is born, and everything seems to be normal. It's just a little small, but it might be microcephalic if you measure it. I mean, is that baby more likely to have developmental problems later?
Well, there is a correlation of microcephaly, even mild microcephaly, with other problems. It's not guaranteed that there will be problems, it's just a general correlation.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, because it's the more mild any of the diseases are that are associated with mild microcephaly, the more difficult it is to diagnose and say, is this a personality oddity, or is
right.
it actually?
Well, there's also the whole self-fulfilling prophecy thing. Like, if a mother is told, your baby has microcephaly, and we need to watch the baby carefully, that could cause the overdiagnosis of developmental problems because everybody's paying attention. So the slightest thing goes wrong, the baby's a little slow talking or walking, becomes magnified into, yes, this baby does have a birth defect, right? It could impact how the mother treats the baby, and it could impact how the doctors on an ongoing basis treat the baby. The baby may be taken more often for doctor's visits. The doctor may be more, you know, would look at something that a normal baby, they'd say, oh, well, they'll grow out of this. But for this baby, because it's diagnosed as microcephalic, then it's going to be reacted to more.
Yeah. So yes, it correlates with the self-fulfilling prophecy disorder.
Well, yeah, like I that's one of the things. At first, I just accepted the whole microcephaly epidemic, but then when you try to define it, and this is often where you get into trouble, it's like as we learned before, like how do you define polio? When you realize that polio in the 50s and today are two very different things, and right. things that were called polio back then aren't now, and things that were not caused polio might be called polio now. When the definition is so flexible, then you have to ask, are we looking at a real phenomenon, or did we just sort of create a problem? Or in this case, like obviously there's a real problem with certain babies. Did we magnify the problem by our testing methodology?
Right. Well, yeah, there's an epidemic of diagnostics. There's that problem. I know in my polio work, I only considered the severe paralytic cases of polio in order to sort of avoid the complications of crossover diagnoses that would be found with the mild cases.
Yeah, they...
Basically considered paralysis.
Right, because they had three categories of polio, basically. They had the paralytic, they had the non-paralytic, which was often digestive problems like vomiting and diarrhea and things like that, which you know, could be caused by mild exposure to a pesticide. But then they also had the abortive category, which were people who tested positive had no symptoms. And of course, if you think about that for a while, you start to say, well, if you have this deadly virus and you actually have no symptoms, is it really a deadly virus? And is there something going on that it turns that means that, you know, person A is exposed to the polio virus and has no symptoms, person B becomes paralyzed. What other differences were there between persons A and B? Is the polio virus working alone, or is it even the cause at all? Those are questions.
Well, at the time, they were even saying that, they say that it starts as a common cold and the flu. So if you had a cold during the polio epidemic, politically, they would be tempted to say you may have a mild polio, you know?
Yes, and of course now they would never say that.
Because they're too busy trying to pin symptoms on other diseases, like HIV also starts with flu symptoms.
Well, in some cases, they try to say that's always the way, but basically what they do, we're going on a lot of different topics here, but if you're HIV positive, and let's say that, you know, you test on a certain day, you're sexually active, and they will say, okay, have in the past, since your last HIV test, which might be, if you're a gay man, maybe every year, but most other people will be less frequently, since your last HIV test, have you had cold symptoms, fever, cough, diarrhea, those kinds of mild symptoms? And the chances are most people will say, yes, you know, 6 months ago, I had what I thought was the flu, and they'll say, that was when you got HIV infected. Especially if they can link it, did you have sex within the months before you had those flu symptoms? Well, you know, a lot of people are going to have flu maybe once a year, and if people are sexually active, then guaranteed they had sex in the months before they had the flu. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, a lot of cyclic logic, of course. That's sort of the trademark of modern medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Political associations, whatever's convenient for them, you know.
Yeah. So, it was similar. I'm thinking here, you know, you have a real problem, but based on the way you measure it, it expands.
The thing is, they didn't just measure this on percentile, but I think the beauty of this thing, this epidemic, is it's really, they were just measuring head circumference. And they noticed a historical trend, because they mm-hmm. compared it with years of... There's a constant sampling of population of head circumference in the previous years. So they just compared it year by year by year by year, and they noticed it in July 2012. Suddenly, they're having it fall into the mild microcephaly category.
And did this correlate with other measures of the body, such as like body weight or the length of the baby? Because presumably they take multiple measurements, right, for babies?
Yeah, there's all kinds of, but all they did here was they just measured the population, a large part of the population. They just measured head circumference. And they're just dealing with these general averages. And they didn't really compare it with body weight or anything like that, but they're just saying in general, a newborn head circumference changed, you know, and they just tracked it from before.
That doesn't really make sense. Like if you knew, for example, that the body weight was declining after 2012, you would say, well, the head circumference is just due to the reduced body weight, and we need to find out why the babies are being born smaller. If you know that it's independent, then clearly that's a completely different circumstance.
But you're saying they didn't track body weight at the same time. So that's another concern. But in terms of head circumference, they did notice whether that represents a different ratio of body weight to head circumference or whatever.
I mean, that seems really...
They didn't go into that.
Right. That seems really important to me.
They just said this is head circumference, and we've noticed that head circumference changes. Now, that represents some kind of disorder, whether or not it's accompanied by body weight or not. Maybe it's not even microcephaly, like you're surmising. If it corresponds to body weight, But the thing is, body weight actually does correlate with head circumference, with microcephaly. They notice that generally when you have microcephaly, you also have what they call intrauterine growth restriction.
Right.
There is actually microcephaly is more an indicator of intrauterine growth restriction.
Right.
That is something that it would have been smart of them to measure. But the thing is, in terms of publicity, in terms of what everybody was seeing, it was his head circumference. So they just limited it to the head circumference. I think I think they had easy access to body weight, but they just measured head circumference.
These kinds of definitional issues can change how people deal with things, because if you focus on the head, you might just be using it as a surrogate for growth. But the fact is, if you tell everybody that, you know, we have a reduction in a head size, people aren't going to be thinking, well, maybe it's the general nutritional status of the mother that's causing more Brazilian mothers to have underweight babies. People aren't going to think that, because you're not talking about body weight or the length of the baby. You're talking about microcephaly. So people are going to immediately think about the babies who have tragically small heads, who are seriously disabled.
Right.
It might just be a general nutritional problem, or it might be that pesticides or vaccines or something are having a small impact on growth, which is measurable by statistics, might not be too noticeable by clinicians.
Right. It could be other things if they correlated in time and place and some kind of historical capability to cause microcephaly or IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction. But that's all these other specs. The mainstream was very willing to entertain all of the environmental concerns that everybody was talking about, the vaccines, et cetera, and the herbicide. However, they oddly avoided any mention of concern about ultrasound or even X-rays. They never mentioned X-rays. It's almost like the elephant in the room, you know, like, hey, why aren't you talking about X-rays? You know?
Well, I wouldn't say that they really examined environmental causes.
But they were willing to make it a conversation, a public conversation.
They were willing to explain why they were not a problem, why they could not cause it. I think they started from the point of view, pesticides and vaccines did not cause this problem. How do we explain that to the public? When I read I think it was in the New England Journal of Medicine paper by the CDC, which was their attempt to kind of launder their theory, make it a scientific theory, they would publish a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, and then they could quote this paper to say, here's the scientific backing for the theory we created. They said in there that they evaluated all other potential theories, but they never listed those theories.
Well, actually, if you go into a document called James Lyons, I think it's 2016, he goes over 10 different theories and combinations of those theories, including the genetic theories,
mm-hmm.
and evaluates each one in a intellectually comprehensive manner.
But he's an outsider. He's a vaccine critic.
Well, he's a vaccine critic. He's basically a geneticist.
Right, but my point is that's not the establishment examining all of the theories.
Well, he is the establishment. He's a PhD medical guy. He's written a lot of medical books. He belongs to a... one of the things he does is he criticizes vaccines, but I...
That alone puts him outside the medical establishment, right? Like, I'm talking about the CDC, the Brazilian equivalent, people like that.
He's totally within the medical establishment, and he is just a critic of the medical establishment, but he is the medical establishment.
Mm,
he's published, he gets published...
Yeah, I've talked to him.
He uses all the standard techniques, the standard rationale. He promotes the whole idea of the existence of Ebola virus epidemics and why there are not more funding going towards vaccine production and research. He's pro-vaccine, you know. He just thinks that the science is inappropriate and there's not enough funding. He's really heavy into trying to get funding for vaccine studies and vaccine development.
I interviewed him, and that's definitely not what I came away with the conclusion. I agree that he's a credentialed scientist, and there's a fair number of credentialed scientists who are extremely critical of certain theories, like Peter Duisberg with HIV, for example, or Peter Gottschy with mammography. I mean, these are guys with a scientific education from respected institutions. They have PhDs, MDs, whatever they need, but they've come to conclusions that are outside the pale. I'd like to see something like the CDC seriously addressing the pesticide issue, but they probably were involved in putting larvicides into the water. That would be something the CDC would do.
Okay.
Because.
So you're saying James Lyon is not pro-vaccine?
He had a lot of lot of questions. I mean,
he shows how science is corrupt and how they're downplaying the toxic aspects of vaccines, but he's for the vaccine, and he thinks that they should be done better. And in many ways, he's like Wakefield in a way. Wakefield is not anti-vaccine. He's for a better vaccine or a better way to apply vaccines.
Yes, but he's also blaming vaccines for the autism epidemic, which puts him
well
outside the pale.
Right, because the vaccines are manufactured badly. The research is not funded enough to really come up with the appropriately manufactured vaccine. And also, you know, he discusses, I saw his lecture. I went to his lecture at NYU, and I researched him, et cetera. And he does a good job of delineating the corruption in studies of vaccines,
mm-hmm.
but not of the disease paradigms themselves.
Right, I agree with you. He's not he's not the most radical vaccine critic. I don't think he's questioning the existence of viruses, for example.
Nor the benefit of vaccines. He's not questioning that.
Yeah, that could be, but I guess I'd like to see somebody who was from within the establishment, you know, that doesn't criticize vaccines and thinks the CDC is a wonderful organization, that World Health Organization is a wonderful organization. I'd like to see somebody like that seriously going through the alternative theories of the Zika microcephaly epidemic, because I haven't seen anything like that.
Aside from being critical of vaccines, I think, well, anyway, there is that document out there, and I hope maybe you've read it, I don't know, where he does go through the 10 different, or 10 or more different possibilities. But sure, they should do a rigorous review of let's say, the application of the vaccines. I think it's the DPT vaccine in Northeast Brazil. At the end of 2015, and see how that affected the epidemic. However, even then, that vaccine would only be, because of its timing, a contributor to the epidemic. It would not be a cause of the epidemic, which really began 2012. If we're talking about an epidemic of head circumference,
right,
which really is what we're talking about. They're just leaking it into
right.
publicity.
I mean, I'd like to know how many cases of head size associated with serious developmental disorders. You know, in other words, a baby that at birth or shortly after is missing their milestones, as opposed to we have a measurement, the head's too small, this may or may not cause problems in the future. But anyway, well, that's...
One interesting thing which I think might help resolve this, what we're talking about, is that this epidemic is not... It is stated by clinicians on the scene and other scientists who are studying this epidemic that it's not really a microcephaly epidemic. It's a general... It's a syndrome of optional diseases, just like HIV
Ebola.
ASD, autistic syndrome. It's really not any one thing. It's just a general collection of diseases of which if you have most of these kind of things, then they call it that disease. Microcephaly is just the most obvious, which it can't avoid.
Right.
If you want to say it's actually more probably a heart disease epidemic or a heart or an organ general organ failure epidemic or in the future they may look back on this and say, well, this is really the greatest autism epidemic.
Right. I'm not saying that a trend in reduction of head size isn't a bad thing. I'm just saying that maybe it's a trend in overall body size, which is also not a bad thing, but the measurement kind of controls how you think. Yeah, the measurement kind of controls how you think about it. If you knew that body size was...
Yeah, they admit that. They say that microcephaly is a child symptom of a greater, more common disease, which is the IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction. It's one of manifestations of intrauterine growth restriction, but there's no fixed rules. You could still have a big body and a little head and still have microcephaly and still be part of this whole disorder. But generally speaking, it's just a mix of dysfunction, you know. And that's, I think, another argument that it's environmental, you know.
Yeah, I think we can both agree that it's environmental. Anyway, talk about this whole ultrasound thing. So this network, like, who funded this network?
It's a nonprofit. I could never figure out exactly who's funding it, but they've been going on since 2011. It's interesting that they... And in 2012, they began their operation, their ultrasound operations, their telemedicine operation, and they work with the government. Their client membership was gained from the ongoing governmental health programs for the Northeast region of Brazil. And at the same time, I noticed that the Siemens medical device manufacturing group was opening an ultrasound factory in 2014. So I think this is all probably coordinated.
In Brazil?
In Brazil, you're right. An ultrasound factory was being built, and I think GE also was building some kind of a manufacturing presence.
So you're manufacturing...
This is all... And this is all coordinated, of course, with sales, promotion, government lobbying, changing medical protocols, and I'm sure that the lobbyists are, you know, our medical system is heavily...
Well, it makes sense. Presumably, they're opening a factory in Brazil because they want to sell them in Brazil, probably because... of, you know, Brazil laws, it's going to be a lot easier to be selling ultrasound equipment manufactured in Brazil than importing it from, say, Germany or China, wherever.
They want to sell them in their products in Brazil, and Brazil is probably saying, we want you to establish a manufacturing presence here because we want to increase our employee population. You know, they want to have jobs. It's all part of the...
Right.
Like, if you want to build up... If you want to sell automobiles, Japanese automobiles, the United States makes Japan manufacture in the United States so that we can all benefit from the profit. And also they get around the customs.
Somebody should tell Donald Trump that. Donald Trump seems to think that all Japanese cars are built in Japan. But anyway, that's an aside. So we have at least one factory producing ultrasounds, and you're right. Like they would say, how do we increase the sales of ultrasounds? Well, I mean, if I was in marketing, I'd say, well, you know, we should say that, you know, should improve prenatal care for poor women, and we can do that. But then probably somebody said, well, how are we going to stock all of these little clinics in thousands of tiny little villages around the country? So somebody came up with this brilliant idea of using telemedicine, which would be a brilliant idea if ultrasounds were really what they were racked up to be. But I think our previous discussion showed that there's some problems associated with ultrasounds.
Yeah, right. Well, there is a lot of confluences here commercially. There is an area of prenatal medicine, and there's postnatal, neonatal. Neonatal is dealing with newborns, mm-hmm. and then you have the prenatal, which is you would require a prenatal toxic agent in order to cause microcephaly. It couldn't be a postnatal mm-hmm. unless mm-hmm. it was
right.
or neonatal unless it was really severe.
So something has to occur while the baby is a fetus before it's born to cause a birth defect, obviously. Okay.
Right. And they know that whatever agent caused this, it was active in the womb, usually after the 20th week, and for a few months after.
And this is on the basis of the type of defects, or like how do they know this?
Well, they're using Zika virus infection as a symbol for this toxic event.
Mm-hmm.
They've noticed that this is, and so they're saying that the Zika virus infection occurs at these times. They notice in the woman with the rash and the fever that the pregnant women are having, they notice that it's occurring after the 20th week. But this period they're talking about, where they claim that there's a Zika virus infection, is the same period that you're going to have the most frequent ultrasound sessions prenatally. So,
and how often do women have ultrasounds with the network?
Through the network?
Yeah, like how would a woman have an ultrasound? A pregnant woman have an ultrasound every month? Like what's the protocol?
I don't know. I don't know the details of how they did that. I know that they're very excited about their mission of applying ultrasound by their attitude, and I know the general protocol for administering ultrasound. The type of ultrasound they were using was echocardiography, which means they're studying the fetal heart. That was almost their entire mission, was studying the fetal heart.
Okay.
And that's a high-powered use of ultrasound. It's very dangerous. And yet they were educating operators through the internet using this. It's a clumsy process. You know, it's even in a perfect situation, it's still a high-risk situation.
And so with the ultrasound, they can see the beating heart, and then I guess they can say the heart's normal.
If they see something wrong, or they think they're seeing something wrong, then they can prepare better for the birth, so that when the child is born, they'll know exactly what to tell the surgeons who are waiting mm-hmm. for the child.
Right.
Although really, I think obviously, given that ultrasound is so dangerous, I think they should just wait until the child's born, and if they see a heart anomaly. Basically, what they used to do, they would just wait till the child's born, and then they checked its oxygen, its blood oxygen level, and if that's down, then they might suspect that there's something wrong with the heart. Even then, I believe Robert Mendelson wrote long decades ago that this whole thing about heart problems in babies is a possible scam, because the prenatal and the postnatal neonatal baby, is the heart is developing rapidly, and to claim that there's an anomaly that requires surgery, open heart surgery on a newborn, is a scam. It's a very profitable scam.
Right, and very dangerous. Can I connect these two things together? You said that you thought that this microcephaly was really a heart problem, and there's ultrasounds focused on the heart. Like, are you saying that there's a connection between those two things?
I think it's one of these. It's like ultrasound is like a toxic eye. It increases your vision, but it's causing problems at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
System does everything it can to avoid publicity about the risk of ultrasound. And it, obviously, ultrasound, and there are even studies, epidemiological studies that involve ultrasound diagnostics, but it's kind of comical because they're using something that could be causing the diseases they're claiming they're finding.
Yes. Well, that is not that unusual in medicine.
Right. It's just another version of the standard mainstream cycle, like their antibiotic cycle, where they give antibiotics but they cause problems and then they need more
antibiotics. Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you look at it from a financial perspective, this is always a really good thing. If you look at it from the perspective of the health of the patients, not so much. I mean, I think Brazil is a country with a lot of economic inequality, and it always seems that they want to do some token efforts to improve the life of the very poor without actually dramatically changing things so that the poor become non-poor. And things like fluoridation, vaccination, and maybe this remote ultrasound sort of fall into the category of what can we do that's cheap, that will, in theory, improve their lives.
Yeah, if they can think of something profitable, they'll do it, whether it improves their lives or makes them worse.
Well, it is always that, right? Like, if you set up a network of ultrasounds, then somebody's going to be selling a lot of ultrasound machines, they're going to be employing a lot of people, and it becomes an institution that wants to defend itself.
I think the greatest thing about ultrasound is you're creating an investment. You're not going to have a healthy baby, you're going to have somebody who is going to spend their life going to doctors.
In the cases where the ultrasound causes damage.
Right, right.
Which, of course,
according to the research I'm reading, there's a good argument to say that any ultrasound always causes some kind of permanent problem in a child,
One of the things on your webpage, sort of introducing your book, was you said that in 1991... some organization was the FDA allowed the increase in power of the ultrasounds by a factor of about 7?
Well, yeah. As of 1991, the FDA changed the regulations to allow ultrasound machines to be made with between 8 and 15 times greater intensity than they had previously. And that 1991 also marks the great multi-epidemic increase in child disease, the rising trend of autism, ADHD, and many other diseases, allergies, child cancer, something, child ocular problems, hearing problems.
Right.
Things are epidemic since 1991.
Right. The problem with those things is that so many things have changed. Like, I interviewed quite a while back a guy who's a real critic of aspartame, which I think was approved in 1984. So he has a whole bunch of graphs that are showing all of these conditions that increased dramatically since 1984, with the implication, even though he didn't claim it, the implication that there's a causative relationship between aspartame and all these conditions. And I believed him that aspartame is a danger, but I'm not sure I believed him that it was related to all of these things, including autism. So you have a correlation between autism and the amount of ultrasound. How do you find out whether it's causative or not?
Right. Well, I know it's these sweeping. That's just one correlation. It's a matter of building up a mass of correlations and watching them all point at the same direction. Autism, for instance, is known to occur in the womb, just like Zika virus supposedly occurs, infection occurs, which is at the 20th week and thereafter for a few months. It's a critical period of exposure to some toxic agent. And ultrasound fulfills that, and then empirically it fulfills the ability to create neurological and hormonal damage. On the large timeline that we were just discussing, it fulfills that. And then also you can discount vaccines and reduce them down to a contributive factor for ultrasound by referring to the histories of Cuba, for instance, where they have a 100% compliance of all vaccines, including the MMR, yet they have no autism. But what's different about Cuba? It has no ultrasound machines, no modern ultrasound machines, because they couldn't afford them. They had no money. And, similar history in Japan, where you look at it and you realize that the vaccine autism correlation just doesn't.
Well, I would guess, I mean, this is totally new to me, I've never heard this before, but I would guess that Cuba probably is giving a lot less vaccines than the United States, because, again, they can't afford to give all of the vaccines. And probably the newer vaccines, the ones that contain high levels of aluminum, like HPV, may not be given at all. So I'm not sure that completely gets rid of that. But one thing you said, you said that whatever it is causes it during development of the fetus, but in actual fact, autism is often only detected later in the child's life, like at 6 months, a year, 2 years. And a lot of people have...
Often at 2 years they detected, but...
Right, and often the studies, after...
The studies show that it's... they show that it, the initiation of autism is... The best ideas of when it occurs and when it's initiated is due to brain overgrowth that is initiated in the womb, in the fetus, 20th week thereafter.
Well, I'm sure somebody came up with that theory, but it doesn't seem to tie with the experience of people whose baby or infant over a period of hours, days, or weeks regresses.
Well, yes, it does. It does. If you realize that, for one thing, a child, an infant is somewhat disabled when they're born, and so it's hard to say, "Well, this is an autistic child." And also, the doctors. They have a conflict of interest where they don't really want to say, okay, this child has a problem. They're hoping that, actually a lot of times parents will say, oh, my child has a problem, but the doctors and midwives will say, well, they'll grow out of that. Don't worry, they'll grow out of it. But then the child doesn't grow out of it.
I guess it goes both ways. There are probably, I mean, one of my daughters was overdiagnosed at birth. And we went through a lot of grief to prove that she was perfectly normal, because myself and my wife at the time felt that the baby was normal and felt that this, you know, newly graduated doctor was panicking at the slightest deviation from what the baby was supposed to do. So there's that, and then there's probably also parents who. You know, are convinced there's something wrong with the baby and harass the doctors until they get a diagnosis. I'm sure there's both things that happen.
Right. Well, there is also a desperation in parents to believe that they want to believe the doctor that the child will grow out of it, and they certainly don't want to. They're very happy. I mean, desperately happy to want to believe that their child's okay. So when a doctor says, "Oh, your child's going through what every other child is going through," and it will grow out of this. I think generally that's probably the more common case.
The stories that I've heard from parents, mostly mothers, about their children is a sudden change following vaccination, sometimes within hours, sometimes within days, and that the child was developing perfectly normally. Now, possibly all of those parents are deluded, and the doctors had been telling those parents since birth that there was something wrong with your child, and then bang, it happens, and the parent says it happened suddenly. But I tend to believe these parents' stories, because the parents, especially the mother, they're often with the baby almost 24 hours a day. So they see very slight deviations from normal. They see what the baby's doing, and then they see a change. And sometimes there's a positive, the baby takes their first step or whatever. Other cases, they're negative. Like the baby that was toilet trained goes back to soiling their diaper. And that can happen even with normal babies. If a baby gets sick, they may revert, right? And parents notice that, and then the baby goes forwards again, and everybody's happy.
I agree. I'm not arguing against vaccine causation, but I think the perspective, I think, is a little different than a lot of people realize. For instance, if you watch this movie called Vaxxed, it's basically arguing for vaccine causation of autism. Now, two of the interviews, however, support the idea that it's not vaccines. If you listen to the interviews closely, the producer of Vax is Polly Tommy, one of the producers, and her child is autistic, and she says it's because of the vaccines. However, when you listen to her story in the movie, she says, we went and we had our vaccination. The child then began to show symptoms. We then went back to the doctor, and the doctor gave the child antibiotics. Then things got worse. He gave me antibiotics to give the child, so I was giving the child antibiotics regularly, and pretty soon the child then fell into what eventually became autism. But she's really saying the vaccines are what brought her back to the doctor. The doctor then made the situation more severe by not doing the environmental study, but by pursuing more toxicity, adding to the mix antibiotics.
I totally agree with you. We've run out of time, so I'm going to give you one last comment before we're done. I'm afraid we have no time.
I'm not saying that ultrasound causes autism, but that it contributes by establishing the initial vulnerability to any subsequent toxicity. It can cause it, but it...
I'd certainly love to see some studies, you know, studying, you know, the amount of ultrasound that babies get, and then look at the general health of the babies who refuse, whose mothers refuse ultrasound, to those who have an ultrasound machine at home, like some movie stars and other rich people. Anyway, thank you for joining me today, Jim. It's always
a
pleasure to talk to you, and it's always stimulating to have a conversation with you.
Thank you, Dave.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 163 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.curro@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.